We're next introduced to Haman, who's not actually a Persian. He's called an Agagite. He's a descendant of the ancient Canaanites. Remember 1 Samuel chapter 15. The king elevates Haman to the highest position in the kingdom, and he demands that everybody kneel before Haman. Well, when Mordecai sees Haman, he refuses to kneel, which of course fills Haman with rage. And when he finds out that Mordecai's Jewish, Haman successfully persuades the king to enact this crazy decree to destroy all Jewish people. And to decide the date of the Jews' annihilation, Haman rolls the dice. A die is called pur in Hebrew. Tuck that away for later. 11 months later, on the 13th of Adar, all the Jews will die. Haman and the king then have a drinking banquet to celebrate their really horrible decision. So the focus now turns to Mordecai and Esther, who are the only hope for the Jewish people. They make a plan that Esther's going to reveal her Jewish identity to the king and ask him to reverse the decree. But approaching the king without a royal request is, according to Persian law, as will arrive from another place. And then Mordecai wonders aloud. He says, "Who knows? Maybe you've become queen for this very moment." Esther responds with bravery, and she purposes to go to the king with her amazing words, "If I perish, I perish." Now, in what unfolds, we watch the ironic reversal of all of Haman's evil plans. So Esther hosts the king and Haman at a first banquet, and she says that she wants to make a special request of both of them at an exclusive banquet the following day. So Haman leaves the banquet totally drunk, and he sees Mordecai in the street. He fumes with anger, and he orders that a tall stake be built so that Mordecai can be impaled upon it in the morning. It seems like things can't get any worse for the Jews and for Mordecai. But all of a sudden, the story pivots. It just so happens that night, the king, he can't sleep. And he has the royal chronicles read to him for good bedtime reading. And he just happens to hear about how Mordecai had saved the king's life. He had totally forgotten. So in the morning, Haman enters to request Mordecai's execution. And the king, in that moment, orders Haman to honor Mordecai publicly for saving his life. So now Haman has to lead Mordecai around the city on a royal horse, telling everyone to praise him. Now this moment in the story, it's a pivot for the whole book. It begins Haman's downfall and Mordecai's rise to power. Watch how this works. The day after is Esther's second banquet. So the king and Haman arrive, and Esther informs the king that, first of all, she's Jewish, and second, that Haman has enacted a decree to murder her, and to murder Mordecai, who saved his life, and to murder all of the Jews. Now, the king's had a lot to drink, so when he hears this news, he goes into yet one more drunken rage, and he ordered that Haman be impaled on the very stake he made for Mordecai. It's ironic and a grisly way for Haman to go. Haman's execution, however, doesn't solve the problem of the decree to kill all of the Jews, so the focus now turns to Esther and Mordecai as they make a plan to reverse the decree.
All right, good morning. Please turn your Bibles with me to Esther chapter 10. That was a little bit of a recap of sort of the story thus far and really what Justin dealt with last week. We're in the middle of a series here called Esther, the Hidden Hand of God. And the reason why it's entitled that and called that is, even though God's name is never mentioned in the book, which is kind of interesting for a book in the Bible, and you see God's hand all over the place. You see him at work all over the place. There's no coincidences here. God is the one actively putting people in positions and situations and giving them opportunities so that they can serve his purposes and ultimately kind of save the Jewish people. So even though, you know, as one of the commentators say, God was never hiding, he was merely hidden, you know, throughout the book. So, you know, the first lesson that we looked at is, as we've walked through the story, we've really looked at different characters. We spoke about King Xerxes and kind of his issues and who he was in character. We also made some observations about first impressions about Esther and really sort of unpacked her beauty and her advantage in life. And then last week, Justin really spoke about lessons from an angry man, who's this Haman guy that really was so ticked off and became so quickly angered because Mordecai, one of the Jews, would not bow down to him, that he literally issued this decree for all the Jews to be killed. All right. So what we're going to do today is we're going to focus in on kind of a very specific chapter, and then I'll tell you how the book ends, and we're going to wrap up the series here today. So I have a lot to cover, but to get us thinking about what we're going to be talking about today, I wanted to know from you, who could tell me who this is? Yeah, it's not my grandmother. Okay, it's not your grandmother either. All right, how many of us here knows who this is? All right, so we have some hands. That's good. All right. So this lady right here, you can go to the next slide, is called Tanny Unts. All right, she's actually the coach behind Wade Funnykerk, 74 years old, and still coaching him. And we obviously know Wade is the reigning world champion, the reigning Olympic champion in 400 meters. He's the only guy who's ran under 10 seconds for 100 meters, under 20 seconds for 200 meters, and under 44 seconds for 400 meters. So the guy's a beast. But that's his coach. All right. Let me give you the next one here. Who could tell me who this guy is?
Tennis coach.
Okay. Show of hands. Who knows who he is? Okay. Where's the tennis players? All right. Next slide here. This guy is called Uncle Tony. He's actually Rafael Nadal's coach. So believe it or not, that was a photo from way back when. Rafa doesn't look that way now. He's much older. But Uncle Tony has been the coach from a very, very young age for Rafa. He's obviously world number one in tennis right now. This year has won the French Open and the last major, which is the U.S. Open, at a fairly old age. He was out by injury, came back, and he's still world number one. So it's remarkable. But we can keep going. But my point is this. We often know the people that win the medals. We often know the people who have their names engraved on the trophy. We often see the stars for who they are, but we very rarely know who the people are behind them that helps them to become that. Now, it's not always the case. I mean, if I were to ask you who Alex Ferguson is, I think all of us will know. Okay, so it's not always the case, but it's often the case that this is what happens. And I think it's a very similar situation about the two characters that we'll be talking about today. On the one side, you have Esther, whose name is on the biblical book. She is the star. She won the trophy. She has the medal. She is the one celebrated really throughout. But the guy that was in her corner, the coach, if you may, is a guy called Mordecai. He is the guy that really works behind the scenes and really helps Esther to become the individual and the person that God desires for her to be. So what we're going to do this morning is we're actually going to look at lessons from Mordecai, focus most of our time there, and then we'll close out making some observations about Esther as well. All right. Have a look with me here in Esther chapter 10. Let's read here about Mordecai and get a little bit more acquainted about what we can learn from him. Verse 1. It says, King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores. And all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai, the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. And then it kind of, you don't have to turn over, it closes out there. I mean, there's literally three verses here, and it's kind of interesting, right? The biblical name on the book is Esther, but who does the book end with? It's Mordecai. And we have a little bit of a snapshot picture of how Mordecai finished. And it says here, obviously, you know, it speaks about kind of the glory and the greatness of King Xerxes and how that was written up even in the books outside of the Bible of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia. But then it also says, not only is Mordecai mentioned in the scriptures, but his name and his greatness is also mentioned in those books. And then it says, he ended up being second in rank to the king himself. Now, I don't know if you can remember this from lesson one, the vastness of Xerxes' empire. I mean, this guy was the king of kings, the lord of lords. He was literally the king sitting on the throne of the world power at that time, 127 provinces. Mordecai was second in charge, which really meant that he was the guy in charge, because the king would rely on sort of the second in charge to administer and run that whole country. So he finished well. But what's kind of cool is it says that he was preeminent. which can mean that he was well known, he was distinguished, he was famous among the Jews, and he was held in high esteem by everybody. So it's kind of a great story about how Mordecai ends. Now, what's amazing here is that God is obviously the one at work, even in Mordecai's life, and how his story almost mirrors Esther's story. Esther was an average Jew that lived in a capital city that almost by accident becomes the queen of Persia. Right, you have Mordecai that's also an average Jew. He has a fairly low-level job working in the palace for the king, but he doesn't really do anything of significance. And then really through God's active hand and situations, he becomes and ends up being the second in command of the Persian Empire. It's kind of cool. It's almost like a direct mirror between the two. But let's step back a little bit. Let's rewind and see, how did he get there? What enabled him to become this great? Have a look with me in chapter 2. Right, we're going to read a little bit in chapter 2, and then most of our time will be spent in chapter 4 here, and then I'll wrap it up the last couple of chapters. But here's kind of the big lesson from Mordecai, is that he showed both tender love and tough love. And I know the campus students will be familiar with this term. We talk about this quite often. But Mordecai showed tender love and tough love, and I want to speak about him specifically in relation to Esther. So not generally making observations about his character, but how did he help her to become the queen of Persia? What role did he play in her life to be able to help her? Chapter 2, verse 5. Let's pick up there. It says, now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shammai, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and her mother died. It says, when the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther was also taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had a charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favor. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed the nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. You know, this is kind of the passage that really, you know, shines Mordecai's tender love for Esther sort of through. It becomes very, very clear. You know, Esther's parents, like I mentioned, passed away. We don't really know how. We don't know how old she was, but she must have been very, very young. It says that her cousin, Mordecai, took it upon himself and took the responsibility of starting to care for him. But then it goes over and beyond that. He says that he literally adopted her and loved her as his own daughter. That's a very descriptive statement. So she was not just an add-on responsibility to the family because her parents passed away, but he literally had so much affection, kindness, and care for her that she became like his own blood daughter. You know, verse 11, we see kind of how this tender love shines through. I mean, Esther's obviously escorted. She goes into the harem, and what does he do? You know, he literally paces back and forth every single day to the harem, to the palace, to find out, how's Esther doing? Like, how's she holding up? What's happening to her? How's this playing out? You know, isn't that what we do as parents for our kids? You know, there's a photo that Justin posted. I figured he's not here, so I can do this. Don't tell him when he gets back. But he posted this photo on Instagram. Elena went to the Matric dance with Jonathan Lisick. And obviously she looked beautiful. And then Jay had this t-shirt on. Yes, I do have a beautiful daughter. I also have a gun, a shovel, and an alibi. But it's Justin's tender love for Elena that makes him so tough on the boys. All right, we'll pray for Elena. That's going to be tough. But that's what parents do. That's what fathers do for their kids. That's what we do when we've adopted people and we cherish them and we love them and we care for them. That's the tender love. You know, earlier this week, we were actually at Justin and Irene's house for discipling time, and our little daughter Anzal is growing, you know, sort of tall. And she's used to our house, but not their house. And they have kind of this kitchen countertop, granite top, that runs right around. And so Anzal walks, I'm chatting to Jane, I think Laura's busy with Irene. She literally walks without looking, hitting this thing straight on. Like, it almost looked like she was knocked out, like straight on her back. And then, you know that bad cry where it goes completely silent. And you know, uh-oh. And then it just like, you know, it just bursts. But both Laura and myself ran and sort of, you know, picked her up and kind of consoled her. You know, but that's what we do. When we have tender love, our focus is on comforting the disturbed. Comforting the disturbed. I know when our son was born, 5.5 weeks early, he was in ICU. And his parents, that was the thing that consumed us. Now, there was nothing wrong. He was fairly healthy, but he was early and he was kind of, you know, didn't have a lot of weight on him. So we just drove back and forth the ICU. And sometimes, you know, we'll be pacing up and forth, praying for him, hoping that he'll get better, like asking other people to pray for him. That's tender love. That's what Mordecai had for Esther as he adopted her as his own daughter. You know, tender love is showing kindness or trying to bring comfort to those who are disturbed. It's the ability to have compassion and empathy with people that seem to need it. You see them going through a tough time, and your compassion is aroused to be able to help them out. You see that they're down and out, and you go over to encourage them. You see that they don't walk in with a happy face in a church. You notice that, and you're over there to be able to show them some tender love. You hear that they're sick, and you send them either a text, give them a call, or you go over to drop a meal for them. You write them a spontaneous note just to remind them that they are awesome and that they're loved by God. That's tender love. You know, John 13, 34 to 35 will come up on the screen, but we all know this. This is a deep conviction of this church. Jesus says, "A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." What is he talking about here? He's talking about being my brother and sister's keeper. He's talking about, then this specifically, he's talking to the disciples. This is the love that we have for one another in this room, a tender love. You know, 1 John 3 speaks about that we should not merely love with words and speech, but in actions and in truth. So we can't just see someone down and out or sick or going through a tough time and say, "I'll pray for you, bro. Good luck." No. It's action. It's being my brother's keeper. It's taking responsibility for a person that seems to need this. You know, this has been the hallmark of two Christians throughout the ages. The first century Christians, and it's remarkable how this happened, sort of in their time, during the Greek and the Roman Empire, often children would be left to die if they were the wrong gender. You want to guess what the wrong gender was? All right, it's being female. But there's actually a letter by the first century... All right. There's actually a letter written from a dad to his wife that's pregnant about sort of the kid to be born. And you'll see this up on screen. I think I might have shown this before. But he writes this to her, says, "I ask and beg of you to take good care of our baby boy," hoping, assuming that he's already a boy. "If you are delivered of a child before I return home, if it is a boy, keep him. If it is a girl, discard it." This was not frowned upon. This was not, no one would have had this reaction, all right? Maybe the Christians would have had, and you're a Christian, so it's good that you have this reaction. But in the ancient times, it was esteemed to have a boy. So to discard a girl was just kind of how things worked. And then what started happening is the church and the disciples started picking up abandoned children. And they started this idea of godparents. And then a short while after that, what started becoming commonplace is that children would not only leave their children out to die, but they would start dropping their kids off at monasteries because they know that the disciples of Jesus would be the people that would take their kids in and care for them. Tender love. In the first two centuries of the church, there were two major epidemics that wiped out pretty much a quarter of the world's population. At its height, the second epidemic, historians would say that about 5,000 people were reported of dying daily in Rome alone. And what would happen, as one of the ancient writers write, is that the panic with the general population would be so much that he says this, at the first onset of the disease, they pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, their own family members, throwing them into the road before they were dead. Okay, this is the average Joe Soap that's not a disciple of Jesus. This is how they responded. How the disciples of Jesus respond. You know, the disciples, part of the church, would actually go out into the road and would bring sick people into their own homes and would care for them at the risk of their own health. And it was the disciples of Jesus that started this idea of hospitals, of caring for the sick and ill, that you don't just kind of leave them out to suffer on their own, but you actually show them tender love. You take responsibility for them and you care for them. Now, what does that mean for us? If Mordecai showed this type of tender love for Esther and that's what helped her to become the woman that she was destined to be by God, if that's her role that we can play, what does that mean? Married couples, I think that means maybe taking responsibility for the campus students. All right, I'm going to help you guys out here for a moment for the campus students. But especially those that don't have parents in the church. They've been adopted into God's family. You are their spiritual parents. So that means having them over into your house, getting to know them. If they're going through exams, man, make a meal for them and say, can I come drop it for you? How does that sound, eh? All right, so they're fired up. Campus students. Man, the young parents, we're having a rough time, man. I don't get a lot of sleep. That's why I'm following my notes. But it's being able to have tender love for, not Laura, myself, I'm not going to pitch us, other parents. We're also in that group. But it's, hey, can I come grab Anzal? Can I come look after Lincoln? Can I just, dude, how can I help the kids? Is there something I could do? And it's amazing how many of the married couples have done that for us. Husbands. And I know this because I'm going through this. If you guys have young kids, and your wife is falling apart, and she is. I guarantee you. She's falling apart because she's not getting any sleep. You be the one to offer to take the 3 a.m. shift, even if you have to go to work. I wrote that for me. Okay, my wife's going to keep me accountable. But even if you have to go to work, you be the one that shows 10 to 11 and says, Bookie, Pisanki, I don't know, whatever you call her. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you I'm the 3 a.m. shift guy with a smile on my face so that you can get some sleep. Tender love. Single brothers and sisters, it's looking out for one another. It's taking an interest in one another's welfare. I'm not just talking about going on a date once a week. I'm talking about noticing one another. Where you walk into a room and you see your brother and sister and there's something in your heart that arouses your compassion and says, I want to show some tender love. I think all of us can do with a little bit of tender love in here, right? We need it. We need to be the Christians that Jesus called us to be. That has always been a hallmark throughout the ages and the way that Mordecai loved Esther. You know, what's also remarkable is he showed her some tough love. Have a look in chapter 4. He didn't only show her tender love and adopted her as his daughter and loved her that much and cherished her. But here in chapter 4, we start in verse 1. It says, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes. This is after he learned about the edict of the destruction of the Jews that Haman put in place. It says, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. She's completely insulated in the palace. She has no idea of what is transpiring here. So in verse 6, it says, so Hatak went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain to her. And he told him to instruct her to go to the king, into the king's presence and beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Hatak went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Then Esther sent his reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away, carried out all of Esther's instructions. You know, what happens here is the edict's been issued. I mean, it's kind of been nailed everywhere. Everybody in Susa knows this. And when Mordecai hears about this, he literally just starts weeping and mourning and wailing, and he puts on sackcloth and ash. And this is nothing new for the Jews. When they're in a desperate situation throughout the Old Testament, this is typically how they would kind of rely on God and beg God to somehow do something, you know, to get them out of that situation. You know, and Esther's servants see Mordecai in sackcloth and ash, and they report it to her, and she gets so greatly distressed that she sends the servant back to go and inquire, why are you wailing? Like, why are you mourning? What's going on here? You know, so the servant goes to Mordecai, and then you see this back and forth conversation that starts between Uncle Mordecai, that has shown incredible tender love for her, and Esther, the queen of Persia. Now, this would be at best termed a crucial conversation. Like, I want you to imagine for a moment if this conversation never happened, where the Jews would end up. Imagine for a moment that Mordecai did not take it upon himself to have this level of a conversation with Esther. You know, verse 7, the conversation starts, and Mordecai tells the servant and says, "Well, here's exactly what has happened. Here's the edict that's been issued. Here's the amount of money that Haman wants to pay. Now, I implore you, go to the king and beg him for mercy." How does Esther respond initially? I mean, she is afraid for her life. In verse 10, Esther replies, says, "It's too dangerous. Like, there's a law. If you approach the king without being summoned, there's only but one law. You will be killed immediately unless he kind of extends a golden scepter." That's a bit of a Hail Mary, man. I'm not sure if he's going to do that. All right? Now imagine if Mordecai left it there. Imagine if he decided, "Well, I guess that's a good point. I'm only going to show tender love to her. I don't want her to die. I don't want her to risk her life for this." And he just let it go. But he doesn't leave it there. And he sends back a very, very strong message. Let's reread this and hear the tone of this. Imagine the tone. It says, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to the royal position for such a time as this." Like, what a response. He says to her, no. "I know you're afraid. I know it's dangerous, but don't think if you keep quiet that this is going to help you to escape. Deliverance for the Jews will come. Great faith. He knows that it will come. It will come from somewhere, and then you and your family will perish. I mean, he gives her perspective as well. It says, who knows? Maybe, and he doesn't use God's name, but maybe God has been at work, and you've actually come to the throne for such a time as this. Yeah, and then obviously Esther responds, and we'll focus on her response just now to see what we can learn from it. But what a crucial conversation. What tough love shown by Mordecai, that he has this strong talk with her. You know, Mordecai was able to help Esther to get the courage and the faith that she needed to be the woman that she was required to be for that given situation. But it was Mordecai. I don't know about you, but I think all of us need people like this in our life. All of us need Mordecais. All of us need people to come alongside us and just say it. To sit down with us and remind us of what we have. To help us to get some perspective on a given situation. Either it's us on our own characters or what we've been through, or about a situation that God has placed us in. And to give us direction on the decisions that we are faced with. We all need Mordecais. You know, I've needed some tough life needed some tough love in my life. I remember at age 12, and this is very, very vivid to me, and it was a defining moment, a crucial conversation. I think I was writing geography. And I wasn't really kind of a very disciplined guy on my own back then. So it was about 9 o'clock at night, and my mom knew I was writing the test the next day, and she said, hey, why don't you bring your textbook to me so that I can test and see how well you know your work? Okay, I don't know. Do parents still do that? Yeah. Test the kids? Okay, good. So I thought, uh-oh. Now, my mom is short. She's a triple A personality. She was in the military and is a lawyer. Okay, so she is a package. Like, all right. I love her. This is always recorded, so I want to say that. She's great. She's amazing. But there was a certain amount of shivering that started happening because I knew there's no ways that I studied hard. So we sat down, and she started asking me about clouds and this and that. I didn't know any of that. You know, you kind of make up something. And then she had the talk of my life with me. And she said, all right, go back. I want you to study again. I'm staying up until we get this done. So I thought, oh, okay. So I went back to study, you know, and obviously you don't have to study that long if you're 12. It's a short test. So I think I studied for an hour, came back. She asked me again, still didn't go well. Said, all right, go back. You know, and literally she would send me, you know, back and forth until I knew my work. I don't know. I think I aced that test. But then from then on, she realized, ooh, he's going to need some assistance and some accountability to build some discipline in him. So I became more fearful of my mother's test than the test itself. Because I knew, I didn't care about who says, bakubachanis. If I know she's going to summon me and have this conversation, and I better know my work. Otherwise, I'm in trouble. But it helped me. It helped me in my primary school. It helped me at a very critical juncture in my life to develop the discipline that I didn't actually have myself. And man, I was able to get through primary school, high school. I was able to get a degree at UCT, largely through her assistance at that time. But also, I remember while studying the Bible, sitting down with sort of a couple of guys, and you know, Justin and Vanna, and they challenged me on something, and I was a 20-year-old guy. Justin at that time was 16 years older, 14 years older than me, Vanna 8 years older. So Justin was like, he was baptized when I was 7 years old. That always gives me perspective. When he says something, maybe I should listen. When Billy, I think, is even, I should definitely listen. But I sit with them, and they pitch their case for me about what would be best for me spiritually and decisions that I'm faced with and what I need to make. And in no doubt, I looked at them straight in the eye, these mature guys, and I said, I do not think you should tell me what to do. Okay, now that's the right response. All right. So they were very diplomatic, but they got out of the Bible study. They looked at one another. This is what I heard afterwards. And they said, interesting. So we got together the next time, and they said, well, what did you think of our conversation last time? And luckily, thank the lucky stars, I came into the conversation and said, I just want to apologize. I mean, you guys are here to help me spiritually. You guys have my best interests at heart, and here I am. That did not dissuade them. Goodness me. It was like a boxing match. I mean, they went to the Proverbs, and then the New Testament, and back to the Proverbs, and then this, and then that. I walked out of there, you know, having gotten a spiritual beating, but it was good for me. To this day, I think at that crucial time, if they did not have that conversation with me, I don't think I would have had the level of humility and the willingness to listen and accept advice than I have today. But it was a crucial conversation. I'm sure you have your own stories, but why do we battle to love people this way? I think we have the wrong definition of love. I think with tender love, we get that and we think that's the Christian love that we need to adopt. That's the Christian love that we need to show. Merely care for those who need, you know, are down and out or need compassion and empathy. But we forget that tough love is also love. And that people need that. So I think sometimes we have to embrace that as a definition of love. Otherwise, we're not going to love people all the way. I think sometimes why we don't show tough love to people is we focus on the momentary uncomfortability of the conflict rather than on the necessity for the individual and their future. It is so uncomfortable. I always sweat. All right? When I sweat, you know I'm having a tough talk with you. Or maybe it's hot. All right? But those are the two things. But everything inside of me feels like I want to get out of this situation. I want to get out of this situation. I'm not enjoying this. But I know this is good for you. But sometimes I think we give into that uncomfortability. And we know our husband needs to talk, or we know our wife needs to talk, or we know the person that we disciple needs to talk, but we think, nah, it's too uncomfortable. I'm just going to tap out of this one. And then I think also we don't want to lose the friendship. We think that I'm really putting the relationship on the line, having this conversation, and I might lose this relationship and friendship, so we back down as well. But I think we have to embrace showing some tough love to one another. I think as a fellowship, that needs to be one of the things that we're known for, is tough love for one another. Absolutely tender love as well, but it cannot stop there also. We have to be like Mordecai. You know, when we are about to give in to our sinful nature and we are about to make wrong decisions, we need to be the people that step into that gap, like Mordecai, and love Esther in such a way to give her perspective and to have the talk that she really needs in order to be the person that she needs to be for God. You guys feel good about that? All right. And then I also want to say this. God often sends Mordecais into our lives to help our spiritual stories to unfold the way that He desires them to be. Have you turned a Mordecai away in your life lately? Were they walking the plank, they're having the conversations, but you're the one defending, justifying, putting them at arm's length? You might be preventing God from working in your life the way that He desires to through somebody like a Mordecai. Who knows? Maybe for such a time as this, He sent a Mordecai on your way to help you to be the person that you need to be. Let's turn our attention to Esther here for a brief moment. How does she respond and what can we learn? What's very obvious, and I think we know this well, you know, many things have been said about Esther, but she picks faith and courage instead of fear and failure. That shines throughout this chapter, right? So the first response, she sits down in verse 11. She says, I'm terrified. This is dangerous. I might lose my life. What is she doing? She's counting the cost. She's sitting down and really estimating about what is this going to take from her. And I think that's very important for us as well, that spiritually we need to count the cost sometimes. Before we make decisions, before we just kind of jump into situations, that we sit down and contemplate, what is this going to require from me? And not just make emotional decisions. But she doesn't only stop there. In verse 15, we'll reread that again. It says, then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instructions. What decision does she make in the midst of being terrified? She decides, I'm going to pick courage and I'm going to pick faith. So she looks at the situation very plainly with great realism, but then steps out and says, I'm in. This could cost me my life. This could cost me my title as queen of Persia. But if I perish, I perish. And then she comes up with a plan. She gathers, you know, tells Mordecai, gather all the Jews in Susa and fast for me. Please implore God for me. I need this. You know, and then also she says, we'll do the same in the palace. We'll fast for 3 days. And then we see in chapter 5 and 7, we see how shrewd she is in unveiling this plan of first inviting the king to the banquet. And then he's like, okay, what's your request? He says, no, I'm not ready for that yet. Why don't you come to another banquet? Maybe she knew that he likes the wine, because that was lesson one, okay? But very shrewd in the way that she deals with it. But there's a plan, a faithful plan, a courageous plan. You know, she had to decide to do that. I think some of us in this room, on one side of the spectrum, when it comes to spiritual decisions or opportunities, we just kind of jump headlong into it. And I think the advice there would be, you need to count the cost. God and Jesus are not interested in emotional heroes that are here today and gone tomorrow, that are, you know, sort of riding kind of the top and then boom, all of a sudden, leave tomorrow. He's not interested in that. You need to count the cost. But I think there's many in this room that is so analytical, skeptical, and afraid of failure that we miss acting on what God is calling you to do. And we give in to that fear. You know, there's a surf poster that will come up here. This was in my room. All right, now this is not the exactly surf poster, but I want to give you an idea. It was a no fear surf poster. This is Waimea Bay and Hawaii. All right. Now, I could keep you busy with this for a long time. I was a bodyboarder when I stayed in Cape Town. This wave breaks in about a half a meter of water, okay, on a sand ledge. So it doesn't look that way, but this guy is about to get the beating of his life. But they ride it in any case. All right. There's actually guys that have been towed in to Waimea Bay that have lost their lives by surfing this specific break. And the poster reads, and it was on my wall. I started bodyboarding when I was 14 and did it until I came to Johannesburg. But it said, don't let your fears stand in the way of your dreams. And then it had this break. I was known to literally break people apart. But in the sport of bodyboarding, fear could stand in your way of surfing and experiencing the most epic waves. There's a moment when you stand on the beach and you look at what's breaking in front of you and you think, this is insane, I shouldn't do it. Then there's a moment where you overcome that. Normally you go with guys and they, you know, everybody's like, let's do this. Everybody paddles out. Then there's a moment when the wave are approaching and as you paddle over the wave, you look back and you go, this is insane. And then there's the moment where you literally see the set rolling in and you are on your board and you are faced with a choice. Am I going to give in to my fear and not go, or am I going to have the most epic experience of my life? And in the sport of bodyboarding, you cannot allow your fears to stand in the way of your dreams. I think Esther might have had a moment where she was faced with that choice, and she picked courage. She picked faith. But I think some of us in here have been coming to church for months, maybe even years, and you've heard from this pulpit, if you are interested in growing spiritually, ask somebody to study the Bible with you. And you're kind of on the wave, you want to take off, but you feel like, oh, I'm not ready yet. I can't do this. And you've backed out. What I want to say is, don't let your fear stand in the way of your dreams. God is desiring for you to have an incredible relationship with Him. Just go for it. Maybe you've started studying the Bible and the road is getting narrower and narrower and narrower, as it should. And the guys or girls that are studying the Bible with you have called you to make certain decisions or give certain things up. And again, you're on the wave, you're right there, but you feel like, I'm not ready yet. I can't make that decision. I can't give that up. I can't make that sacrifice. And what I want to say to you is, don't let your fear stand in the way of your dreams, of God's dreams for you. Maybe you've been a disciple for a while and God has called you to step into a leadership position or to take a leap of faith and do a one-year challenge or just like radically share your faith at work. You know, to be that person. And again, you are, you know, as you're going to work, you're paddling over the waves thinking, I cannot do this. Or you're sitting in your car thinking, man, God, please give me the strength to do this. But the Holy Spirit's been nudging. He's not only nudging, He has been shouting in your ear. Do not let your fears stand in the way of God's dreams for you. But that's a choice you and I have to make. As a disciple, we have to make that choice every single day. Are we going to give in to our situation, circumstances, and fear, as Esther was tempted to do? Or are we going to pick courage and faith and be the disciples that God wants us to be? In closing, it's very clear that she decided to use her opportunity that she's been given, to serve others and not herself. Can you imagine the temptation for an orphan girl that rises to the title and position of Queen of Persia and then being required to give that up? Can you imagine the temptation that she must have felt to say, but this is my time. I mean, this is from God. I'm going to use this opportunity to enrich myself. But yet what you see, she says, if I perish, I perish. God, I'm going to use this opportunity that you've given me, and I'm going to lay down my life to be able to serve you and other people. And this is where Esther's life becomes a foreshadowing of the life of Christ. He left his privileged position at the right hand of God to come down, take on the very nature of a servant, and ultimately die on a cross for you and me. And in a very real way, this woman that becomes this Persian queen was faced with the same choice. Will she use her privilege and her opportunity to look out for herself, or will she leave that and lay down her life in order to serve God and his kingdom? What I want to encourage us with is we face that choice, I think, often as well. What I want to pray is let's pick as Esther did, that let's use the opportunities that God has given us to God's benefit and to his people. You know, last week, Justin closed up with chapter 7 about what happens is, you know, Haman kind of gets impaled on this sharpened stake. And we're gonna let me show you a video about how this closes out here from chapter 8 onwards.
Now turns to Esther and Mordecai as they make a plan to reverse the decree. They discover that the king can't revoke a decree that he's already made. So instead, the king commissions Mordecai to issue a counter decree. On the appointed day that all of the Jews were supposed to be killed, the 13th of Adar, now the Jews are ordered to defend themselves and to destroy any who plotted to kill them. Then Mordecai, Esther, and Jews everywhere hold banquets and feasts to celebrate this new decree, and Mordecai is elevated to a seat beside the king. Eventually, the decreed day comes, and the Jews triumph over their enemies. First, they destroy Haman's family, and then any other Persian officials who had joined in Haman's plot. And then on a second day, they get permission to destroy any who plotted against them throughout the entire kingdom. This results in joy and celebration as the Jews are rescued from annihilation. The story then tells about how Esther and Mordecai establish by decree this annual two-day feast of Purim, to commemorate their deliverance from destruction. And the name of the feast comes from Haman's dice. Remember, Purim. The book concludes with a short epilogue as Mordecai is elevated to second in command in the kingdom, and we are told now of his royal greatness and splendor as the Jews thrive in exile. Now, step back. Notice how this whole story has been designed. The story was full of moments of ironic reversal, but we can now see the whole story is structured as an ironic reversal, right down to the details. So the king's splendor and feasts and decrees are mirrored by Mordecai's splendor and feasts and decrees at the end. Esther and Mordecai, they first saved the king, but now in the end, they save all of the Jews. Then you have Haman's elevation and edicts and banquet that gets reversed by Mordecai's elevation and edict and banquet. And then at the center, you have Esther and Mordecai's planning scenes, and then Esther's two banquets that act as a frame around the greatest moment of reversal in the whole story, Haman's humiliation and Mordecai's exaltation. Beautiful.
All right. So that's the chiasm that Justin spoke about, this kind of ironic reversal. But what an incredible story. I hope it's been helpful as we walk through this to unpack the different characters, but I just want to make this statement. Remember that the real hero and the author is always God. That his hidden hand was at work helping Esther to be there, helping Mordecai to be there, and really helping the Jews to really be saved, and in a very real way for Jesus to be born. God is always at work. Whether we know it or not, whether we feel it or not, I pray that we will be more sensitive to His presence and His hand in our lives. Amen.